this form, so it may just be that I'm going to use it for a week. So, my only one line for mentioning this is I want you to be much more organized in typesetting and drawing and stuff than I am. And so, if you have a canonical way of doing this stuff, keeping it all together in a sort of unified fashion, I'd really like to get advice on that. And if you want to try out this copy of the copy fund, very well, you know. So, okay, so about the talk. My background is classical statistical mechanics, and I sort of come at the problem from the point of view of a statistical mechanics person. So the language I use is a little bit different, and it's really based on counting. And because particles are easier to count than waves, what I'm really going to be trying to do in this talk is to see whether the branch that looks like this. Most of quantum mechanics is really in what I call wave-only paradigm, where the particle is a derived concept. Right? The particle really isn't what we think of as a classical particle. It's more like a wave packet. So there's sort of this picture. There's the pilot wave picture, which is interesting in the primary focus is more like a classical particle. But the wave comes in sort of as a subsidiary concept, constructing the quantum potential. But the thing is, it doesn't seem to be anything that rivals this. It's particle only in the sense that waves themselves are created somehow out of particles. So I'm going to try and see where that gap can be filled in a little bit. So let me just. Then we'll have a quick look at them in terms of what the path integral has to say about these nodes. And when we look back, we say, well, it's an interesting perspective, but where does phase come from? So in the next section, we'll be looking at the case of using negative integers in classical stat math. Usually, you only use positive ones. And then we come to the part that is the most fun. Called the Dirac equation for accountants. And there the object will be to derive the Dirac equation. That is, really derive it, not just invoke it. But derive it in a language that an accountant would be perfectly happy with. And so that the end result of the wave function would be something that the accountant would understand. Of course, there's going to be a continual limit at the end which the accountant wouldn't go for, but we can get as close as we like to it. So we'll go through that argument, and then we'll just look at what the difference is between this derivation and the previous ones. We'll then say it's a little bit about building complex numbers, and then in case you're all too polite, ask difficult questions. I'll ask a few difficult questions here, and then we'll have a look at some conclusions. Okay, so what to talk about? The talk about is that the domain is going to be single particle quantum mechanics. We're really looking to understand solutions of something that looks like this, where H is just a simple Hamiltonian. And the thing is, in quantum mechanics, psi, all you can really say about psi is that some element of probability captures. There's no agreement in the community as to whether psi itself has any physical manifestation. So the reason to attack me from the point of view of a stat med person is, we're very curmudgeonly about what we do, and we need to know what we're looking at. So we want to get to this equation and know what the wave function is. So what we like to do, and we have to be very careful about sort of talking about quantum mechanics and the equations of quantum mechanics. we're going to end up with an honest-to-goodness derivation of the Dirac equation. But that's not to say we're saying anything in particular about quantum mechanics. I mean, we'll look at it, and of course we'll hope it informs us a bit on quantum mechanics. But the equations of quantum mechanics are very different from quantum mechanics itself. So what we'll do is we'll actually find another context for the equation. Okay, so what's the relevance of this to interpretations of quantum mechanics? Well, okay, for me, I really segregate the pictures in quantum mechanics into two types. That's because the interpretation, there are lots of different interpretations of quantum mechanics, and they're all extremely difficult and slippery. So I lump all of them basically into a wave-only type, except for the Broglie bone, which is a pilot wave and has a very different focus. So in the wave-only picture, the objects are waves, and that's fine, so you're dealing with wave equations. Of course, the trouble comes when you think of measurement. The problem with that whole picture is when you get the measurement, then you have to come up with some idea that wave function collapse. And if your expectation is that the theory should provide explanation, you're going to find it hard going. Okay? And as well as an external reality, well, Bohr would say no, but, you know, nobody can seem to agree. Now, in the pilot wave picture, it's quite different. There, the object of study is, in a sense, sort of an honest particle with a smooth trajectory. And it does agree with our intuitive idea about what particles should do. Now, of course, you've got to bring in some sort of interference effect. And the way that's done is through the quantum potential. And if you want to sort of criticize the bone picture, you might say, well, it's sort of like the particles have with them this GPS device that tells them where they are, and a little laptop to solve a wave equation and figure out how they should move. Right? Particle responds to this quantum potential. It's never entirely clear how the quantum potential is formed. It's not formed because of the particle trajectory. The particle trajectory somehow reacts to it. So where we want to go is a particle-only picture, which says, okay, we're going to deal with particles. But of course, then we have to have waves in there somewhere. And the idea is to have waves in from the study of the particle trajectory itself. So that's really our, that's where we want to go. So here's a little figure. So just to sort of explore this a bit more, here's a little figure from Penrose's wonderful book. It's about the double slit experiment, right? And we just want to look at this from the point of view of the wave paradigm. If we look at it from the point of view of the wave paradigm, we look at this thing and say, well, look, okay, when one slit is open, looks fine. When the other slit is open, looks fine. When both of them are open, oh, we get this interference pattern. But of course, that's exactly what we expect if the particles are in amplified waves. Of course, that becomes a little bit peculiar when you think, well, okay, these things actually arrive in these little dots. The extent of the dots are much smaller than the size of the double slit. So if this really is a wave, how come it comes through here and feels both of these things, and then the detector collapses into this, this single click? So, from the point of view of waves, the whole pattern is fine. It's the individual events that aren't so easy to figure out. What about the Roy Bone? This is a crib from Peter Holmes' work. Well, this is a sketch of the trajectories through essentially a double slit. And so, you know, these are representations of the trajectories. And so out here is sort of where one would think of detection. And the nodes here correspond to basically trajectory poor areas. So the way that the Broglie bone works is that just like in the classical potentials, it pushes the trajectories out of the way. So if there's a node here, it's because there are very few paths going there. And if there's a bright spot here, it's because a lot of them end up there. So that's the way that the Broglie bone works. And of course, you have to say, well, how does how does the particle know that it should go on these trajectories? And then, of course, the way it's done is you invoke the quantum potential, and the quantum potential, the particle coming through here, knows about the other slit. And that's a bit peculiar, that's a sort of bit of phenomenology. Now, the only other sort of picture that's common in quantum mechanics that uses the idea of particle trajectories is the power integral. And that's quite a different picture. So in terms of the power integral picture, how you look at it is, well, there's a source here. And there's the two slits, and we're going to detect it up there. And suppose we have this node. What happens? Well, actually happens, you get a node not because it's a path poor area. It's because paths have these little clocks that go along. And, you know, the clocks are the phase. And what happens is to get a node, you have actually trajectories that are in pairs with opposite phase. So there's a cancellation effect. Right? That's a rather non-classical thing. Right? This works because, of course, you cover up this one, and you don't have the one to cancel this one, so the node goes away. So that's more or less how the path integral constructs a node. It's different from the way Roy Boehm constructs a node. Let's see whether we can chase this down a bit more. So the question about the finding paths is, what on earth is phase? What's, you know, why is it there? Classical particles we don't think of as having phase. Well, in actual fact, we don't know what the physical origin of the phase is. There's a lot of very suggestive stuff in the path integral, in the sense that, you know, we're used to seeing this with the path integral. There's the phase that you know, is that the argument is proportional to the action along the path, but you have a square root of minus one. Now, this Boltzmann factor for the Wiener integral, which is just, it's exactly the same thing as the path integral, but you're still in classical physics. All it does is cap. Right, this Boltzmann factor here is a remnant of a counting process that's just counting those paths. So what it looks like is somehow this factor is counting, you know, some a wave. The question is, where the wave is. We're thinking about particles. So we don't know what the physical origin of phase is, but we do know what really the function of the phase is. And the function of the phase is to propagate subtraction. Right, and this is something that's sort of outside the usual domain of classical statistical mechanics. And the example I give here is, if you want a lower lighting here, we usually turn down the switch. We don't turn on the darkness projector. Whereas, of course, in quantum mechanics, that's exactly what you do. You turn on a darkness projector. Go back. Look at this thing. What did we do to make this area a node? What did we do to make it dark? We didn't turn off this, we turned on that. Right? It's a slightly different concept. We're not getting rid of the paths, we're putting in other paths that annihilate the original ones. Okay, so that's sort of basically how the path integral does it. And the question is there anything in classical statistical mechanics that sort of mimics this? And again, we're sticking to classical statistical mechanics because all we want to do is count, and we want to get to these equations. Well, look, here's a simple example of counting. We can think of this, say, in terms of fusion. So our domain here is simply that we're counting paths, and the restriction on the paths is simply that they be continuous. They traverse the domain of interest, so they start somewhere below t is equal to zero, and they terminate somewhere in the future where we're not interested. And they're single bounded. Then, if that's the case, when we count them, all we do is we just use the natural numbers, right? There's a one for each of these. If we sit at some time t and scan the x-axis and cross here and say get one, boom, that makes two. Right? We just use the natural numbers for counting these things. And that's typical. If we choose the path right, of course, and we do this and take a continual limit, we can get diffusion if we make these random walks. And all you're doing when you get the diffusion equation is you're doing exactly that. You're counting one for each path. So, okay, so that's the simple path. What about a path that looked like this? Okay, now, so the kind of path that we're now looking at, they're continuous. They have to go from somewhere, they start somewhere, and T is now oriented. We say it starts somewhere below T is equal to zero, and it has to end up somewhere in the future where we're not interested. And the job is still to count the number of paths. Now here, our previous algorithm doesn't work. Right? We go along here, one, it's one path there. We go along up here, and oops, it looks like there are three paths. There's really only one path. But counting with the natural numbers isn't going to work. What would work is to say, well, okay, we have the herd direction, and we're going to associate a one when the particle is going parallel to the direction, and we're going to associate a minus one when it's going anti-parallel. If we do that and then do the particle count, clearly it all works out, right? We go along here, one, minus one is to zero, one, there's exactly one continuous trajectory. So that's the counting algorithm that's appropriate to this kind of path. And notice that there is this element of propagating a subtraction. Okay? Here, we're coming along and there's a, you know, there are three segments of the trajectory, but this red guy annihilates the blue guy and sort of takes it out of action. So there is this sort of feature of propagating subtraction in this. And so the real question here is, can we organize this?
Well, I'll give you a question.
Yeah.
Does it matter which way you color? You effectively picked the parameterization for one of the data for that. Can you flip it around so the plus ones or minus ones, is it going to make any difference?
Yeah. All it will do is if you flip it around plus ones and minus ones, according to this thing, you flip the sign of your counter, depending on which way you're counting. Here we're
actually, that doesn't even make sense, but I mean, what I'm thinking is you go up to the first little bit there, the positive one, and then you have a three-way.
Yes.
And you can take any one or two of those as going in the positive direction. In other words, they're going this way.
Yes.
That one is only being plus one. So I'm just trying to figure out, you refer to an algorithm and it looks like the algorithm sort of like making this is to have color in it. I'm just trying to get a sense of it.
Okay. Well, the algorithm doesn't really matter what the color is, but the algorithm is simply you discriminate between one direction and another direction with a minus one. So the color doesn't matter. The direction doesn't really matter. All it is, you have to make sure that when these guys turn around, the manifestation of them subtracts. So that's all that's really required. It's just a simple counting algorithm that will, if you imagine a whole mess of these, we throw a whole mess of them down and we don't see at the bottom, you know, how many they are. If we just run this algorithm across the whole thing, it'll sort it all out. We'll end up by counting the number of continuous reactions by doing that. Okay?
So it's not just a simple path, but you actually have a vector at every point. Otherwise, you can't resolve what happens when the path's crossed. That's pointless, right? You actually know that you're going
yes,
that way.
Yes, this is traversal. So the way to think of this is we're orienting T and we're saying, okay, the traversal is going to be this way. And so all we have to do is...
No, but let's say, let's go back and say, what happens
yes.
if I go up to get to the first intersection,
yes.
right? And then you can go in three different ways, right?
You could. If you went this way, uh-huh. it would isolate this guy and it would be...
But you only know that by the fact that you have to then look over the whole thing. You wouldn't know that locally.
Okay. I guess the thought here is that the particle is creating this path. I mean, it's quite true, the particle could do this.
But it does do that. I mean, according to that, right, there's no...
Oh, actually, sorry.
It does both.
Okay, the path, the parameterization I'm thinking of is this. Here is the continuous path. Right. That's the path. entire thread. And the question is, so, you know, we would normally just color a single color, but the color code you put in is, in a sense, you're right, you have to have a notion of direction. As you're going over this path, code it so you can actually do the count. You have to have a direction finder in here that will say, okay, at this point, now we're turning over, and our projection on this axis is negative. So we can color this thing red. Does that?
So the basic objects then are not simple paths, but they're paths with a vector associated with it in a continuing limit.
That's why I'm not writing parameters path, so that they have a number that goes that you follow along, so you know what's in front of you.
So you really think of it as a path, a particle, and then you have it's a trajectory. It's not real time, then. Okay.
Yeah.
So then you have a position and a velocity, and you're talking about that kind of path.
You can think of it in that way. This doesn't have BT. Of course, in the end, it is going to be T. But I'm just thinking of coming up with an algorithm that will allow you to count these things. I mean, just think it's a load of spaghetti dumped down. I mean, the farmers is the pieces are anchored down there. They're anchored up there, and you want to count how many there are, and they've got loops. So the coloring algorithm will just give you a counting mechanism that will allow you to do that counting. Okay, so it's a very primitive thing. It just counts the number of continuous. All right, well, let's just see. And so what we want to do, so here's the idea. These non-simple paths have loops in them that we can count with this simple algorithm do have these features sort of a bit like phase and plus and minus ones. And so the question is, can we organize that in such a way that we actually do get waves? So what we're going to take there in the Dirac equation, it turns out that's the easiest one to get. But first of all, we're going to have a look at the way it's usually produced. And of course, everyone knows this sketch. And it's quite lovely. You start with something that looks like a Schrodinger equation. So in a sense, you input waves here. You then just put in the special relativity with the energy momentum relation. And then Dirac just proposed, okay, well, let's say the equation we're looking for looks like this. Okay, and then you just put that back, and you get the usual anti-commutation relations for the alpha and beta. But the thing to notice is there's no sense in this that psi has any prior physical meaning. Right. There is a sense in which it's formal, but psi has not, we're not thinking of psi as being anything in particular other than essentially an element of this probability. Okay, so what we want to do now is just go to this accounting version. So here's the idea. We've got this accountant. He's got, he's fine with arithmetic. Positive and negative integers and even rational numbers, and you can tell him why he needs to divide. He's not going to be okay with real numbers. Can't be added in finite time. He's not going to be okay with the square root of minus one. It's not in his toolkit. So we want to convince him that we know where the Dirac equation comes from. So the story is he takes his young daughter out for a play on the parking lot of the Brewer Institute on Saturday, and he sits himself down in his deck chair with a gin and tonic, and his daughter plays this game a little bit like hopscotch. She rules the parking lot with these diamonds, and then hops along these diamonds until and the moon takes her and she changes direction. So then she hops a little bit more, and then she drops a mark. Hops a bit more, changes direction. Hops, drops a mark. Up at the end, she comes back down the red path, following markers parallel to the original circuit. So that's what she does. She does it repeatedly. So we imagine our accountant sitting there on his deck chair, and he notices that when he, you know, his kids were circulating around him, he notices that there's always a cyclonic circulation. And in a sense, she creates this vorticity. We can say this is simply an ordered area, and we can, in a sense, associate that with the right-hand rule. We say that's plus, and this is a minus. Okay, so he can sit there, and he'll notice that if he sits right here, it's always cyclonic. If he sits right there, it's mostly anticyclonic. He gets anywhere when you hear, well, these things wash over him, and he's somewhere between the two. So the task is to look at it and say, well, look, is there going to be an equilibrium pattern? If my daughter does this enough times, is there going to be an equilibrium pattern over the whole thing? Well, he can find that out by doing a bit of counting. He can sit there and he notices that as he sits there, the only thing that he needs to see is the trajectory, is the right-hand half, because if his daughter does this, because of the characteristics of the trajectory, we know she'll do that. And if she does this, we know from the characteristics of the trajectory that she'll do that. So he can ignore half of the real half and just look at the what I call the enumerative. And so what we're going to do then is just count these things. We're going to count them by direction. So whenever one goes like this, this accumulates plus one. This accumulates plus one in the other direction. That accumulates a minus one. That accumulates a minus one in the other direction. Okay, so all we're doing is really counting the orientation for these things. So we can sit there and do a lot of counting, but it'll take a long time. So what we can do is just put in a little bit more mathematics and just assume we reach an equilibrium. So what we're going to do is say, okay, we're going to count with some density, which we're going to call u plus or minus, the plus for the right hand, minus for the left hand. And so the u plus counts the number of ones in the one direction, and the minus one direction. Okay, and there's a sign depending on whether it's traversed from forward or backwards. And from the stochastic process, we're going to make it stochastic so that the decision to change direction of drop and marker is going to be epsilon n, where this is a small number. Epsilon is actually the length spacing. So this is very much less than 1. And with probably epsilon n, you drop the marker, and the path itself turns. And when you look at the path that's doing the counting, let's just take one more look at that path. We'll see that left and right aren't treated quite symmetrically. Now, if we're sitting here, if we're sitting on a plus link, well, either we came from a plus link and the sign of the contribution didn't change, or we came from a minus link, so the sign of the contribution did change. Whereas if we're on a minus link, no matter which one it is, whether it's blue or red, the sign doesn't change. It's just part of the process, it's part of the geometry of the path. The sign changes, the sign changes if we're going from left to right. Going from right to left, it doesn't change. Okay. So that is manifest in these equations that just are counting the contributions from these paths. So there's one for the u plus, there's one for u minus. So this minus there reflects the fact that you change sign when you're going from left to right. This plus reflects the fact that you don't when you're going from right to left. So that's we have these two different equations that just do the counting of these paths. And the accountant is happy with them because this is just a rational number, these guys are just rational numbers, and you know exactly what it is you're counting.
Is U a stochastic variable or an average here?
It's average. It's,
okay.
And it, it's,
right.
It's
right.
Okay. Yeah. So, in spite of it being an average, of course, it has to respond to the actual trajectory of the geometry, which is why you get these. So, let's just have a better look at those two difference equations. We can see there's going to be an exponential decay in that, right? The guy sitting at the base of this thing is going to see all of these paths, and he's sitting a long way from where she comes back to. Those trajectories are spread out over space, and the result of that is this thing has an exponential decay built into it. So we can just remove the exponential decay by this transformation, and those are the difference equations that we end up with. And again, they're perfectly simple. We know exactly what we're counting, and hopefully the accountant would object. But of course, being physicists, we're now going to do something that is objectionable for an accountant. We don't like difference equations, so we're going to take a continual minimum. It's easy to do. We just subtract W plus or minus from the left-hand side, divide by epsilon, and take the minimum as epsilon goes to 0. This is what we get. We can then write this in a two-component form. Just putting these things in, we're going to use the change in sign from here. You know, the cross terms have there's a minus sign up there, which is in here, and a plus sign up here, first the plus sign down there. So we can write that as I times sigma y, just so we keep the notation on the family. We end up with this. Right? That's a form of the Dirac equation. The solutions are real, because I sigma y is real, and everything else is real. We can here y is t. Notice it's t and not it, because we don't need to analytically continue to do this. Reiterate this twice, we get the Klein-Gordon equation. So, again, notice that the description we got there, they are wave equations, but there's no waves in it, right? All it is counting these paths. So, let's, in a sense, do our remark as well. Let's just say what we didn't do. Okay, in getting here, we haven't said anything about the uncertain principle. There's no quantization involved, there's no Schrodinger's equation, there's no complex numbers, and no special relativity. There's nothing in the sense of interpretations. All we've done is taken the output of this sort of counting argument and written in the language that's familiar to us. Okay, so just about the equation, that just tells us that, reminds us that it's a different context. We now know what psi is in this context, but of course this isn't quantum mechanics, this is describing these point trajectories. Okay, now what's different about
the... Sorry, can you get the previous...
Yep.
The one before. Two things happen there. One is this imaginary eye, which I don't understand. Why? What's the...
Oh, the only reason I put the eye in there is because sigma q isn't a Pauli matrix. Right. So I'm just making the notation so we recognize it from the Dirac equation. We don't need to. We can write this as partial root of w with respect to y is minus sigma z partial root with respect to x w plus sigma q w and w.
And the second thing is that when you take the continuum limit,
yes,
what is the picture? What
okay, the picture in that is it's sort of a fine continuum. But let's go back and see what it does to trajectories. Okay, so here are these trajectories. We've said this, there's a little lattice sitting in here, and this path is generated by just saying, okay, with probability 1 minus epsilon n, I'm just going to keep going in the same direction. And then probably epsilon n, I'm going to change. Right? Now, as epsilon goes to zero, probability going straight increases, but the glass spacing goes down. So what happens is you get an expected length, which is, in the context of the Dirac equation, it's the constant length. So as you refine the lattice, these things, they still look basically the same, that they're, you know, that they're slightly different lengths, but their average length is a constant. Okay, so it's a fine continuum limit that signals out this this constant length as being the average, but the actual manifestation of the trajectories is simply that they all hang around the constant length.
Where do you get the constant length comes out that you don't have an h-bar in there yet?
Yeah, so h-bar is 1, c is 1, it comes from the m, right? The probability is epsilon m is an h-bar. So that's where the...
So you do have it, okay, I thought you said in the list that you didn't have.
Okay, the constants are all of this is it's all scaled by n and whatever units that you do. I'm drawing this in the sense where c is 1, and h bar is 1.
Yes, you can easily put c and h bar and boom, change anything.
Yes, all it does is scale. Yeah.
So I'm curious about why there's no it. So this is really propagation in Lorentzian time.
So it looks like propagation in Lorentzian time, but this is, you know, the first part of this argument was completely put this in a physical context. We started this argument by saying this is y, this is x, and here are the paths, and we said the counting is going to be appropriate to this geometry. The earlier part of the argument was to say if we wanted to count trajectories.
That's fine. I don't need that.
Okay.
I'm looking for that. Just in terms of what happened when you took the continuum limit.
Yeah.
You get an equation whose square is del y squared minus del x squared.
Yes.
Okay. And there's no way you could have made a different choice in getting del y squared plus del x squared.
I could have, yes. If you wanted to go, if you wanted to go the other way, you ignore the orientation and you just count. But actually, that's not quite true. It's not. Yes, sorry, it is. The y and the x, the y is the t and the x. So to get the other, which corresponds to the classical case, if you ignore this orientation and say, I'm just going to count paths, it'll change the sign.
Right. So that's the key.
That's the key, right. It occurs here. We'll actually track this. We're going to track this pretty carefully because it is important. There it is. Right there. There's the famous minus sign, which you all know from Nelson's book. Okay. So that's where it is. So we're at the point of saying, okay, well, what didn't we do? Well, in actual fact, we didn't invoke any physics at all. We only had a geometry. There was no uncertainty principle. It's no quantization, no complex numbers, no special relativity. It's nothing to do with any interpretations. And all we've done is we've taken the apple, it's a very, very simple accounting argument, and ended up with this thing that was like a wave equation. So that's peculiar. Why is it peculiar? Well, I can say that, you know, all derivations of the Schrodinger Dirac equation, they come from the part of the paradigm. They're actually invocations, they're not derivations, in the sense that you always have to be confronted with bringing in the complex algebra. So canonical quantization is an explicit formality equation. There it is right there, right? There's the I, there's the I. We're just taking a 1 and replacing it by an I that brings us into the complex field and we're done. Nelson's work was very clever. This is work in 66, where there was no explicit analytic continuation, and you stare at that for a long time. It's very complicated to put. But what actually happens, you know what happens physically, is simply that you start out with a diffusion equation, two components, And just at the right point, you say, we're going to make this reversible. And the physical process can't support that reversibility in the real number field. So it builds in an algebra. So it's a global condition enforced on the system, and that's great. It shows you the connection of reversibility. Of course, it doesn't actually tell you how to do that from the point of view of from the point of view of the attack of powers. So now the claim is the above derivation does not do that. There's no formalized accumulation. Why is that? Well, here's a hand waving, but rather, I think, interesting picture of why this happens. So historically and logically, the number systems really go like this. We start with the natural numbers, we go to integers, rationals, reals, and complex. And, you know, where civil mechanics types are home is really in here, in the first bit. And in actual fact, most physical mechanics, all you need are really natural numbers and the positive rational numbers. But as physicists, you know, absolutely 90% of our language is based right here. It starts with reals. And we see the complex numbers as being an extension of the reals. So if we start with the reals in our paradigm, we have to do this extension. It's not clear why quantum mechanics forces us to do that. Now, what did we do in the accounting economy? We didn't do that forcing. There was no global forcing. All there was geometry and this accounting process that was appropriate for powers that could reverse with respect to the preferred direction. And these powers had this built-in periodicity. So what actually happened, remember when we started counting, we counted two components, okay? And so in a sense, it was like two copies of the integers, where we were using integers, not just the natural numbers. We needed the negative contribution, because in the end, we had this thing that we might call propagation subtraction. This involved Q2, which is like the real number, like the complex number in a sense, has the algebra built into it, but it has the discrete units of phase and modulus. And we ended up with the complex numbers. And the complex numbers were appropriate for this kind of counting. And from that, we saw that the real numbers were actually a subset. So the end result for the counting wasn't the real numbers, as you'd expect from this. It's really the complex numbers. So all of that is to say, it's a little bit of a warning that our language here does not our common language, which includes the reals and of course the calculus, is really a bit too coarse to see this. Now, that's hard to get from words, but let me show you a little. I didn't have this book. Okay, so what I want to do is show you this little demo that will allow you to see how the alpha comes in. So I'm just going to let this run through, and then we'll sort of take it apart. The idea here is this is one of the stylized trajectories that I was talking about. You know, that will go through the thing on the parking lot, going back and forth on these entwined paths. And the idea was we're going to count. This counts the right hand contributions. This counts the left hand contributions. Let's just run through that and see what it does. See, there's the trip up, there's the trip back. Here we're doing this counting, and this is the waveform that's being approached. Okay, so we've just changed its time on a bit. Now we speed everything up. Okay, so now the point is, here's the direction. And this, forget about the transient at the beginning and end, that they're a coarse representation of actually the INT. Now, the point is that our language, when we use calculus or quantum mechanics, it actually starts at the continuum minimum of this. And if you start here, your language is too coarse to see that. But let's just go back and have a look and see where the algebra actually comes from. Because, I mean, one person, when I showed this tip to one of my colleagues, he said, all right, maybe you're getting super common, but where's r? Where's the square root of minus 1? Of course, we don't need r, we need an algebra. And if you think about it a bit, it's the fact that we get the trig functions here that has the algebra in it. The best we could do if we didn't have the algebra, we'd get the hyperbolic functions. But anyway, let's go back and just sort of take this apart, because it's interesting to see what the forerunner of the algebra is. Let's go through one cycle. Okay, let's just check the counting. This counts on the right hand. Remember, in the counting, we only need to count the right hand path. So this is saying, well, the one particle that's going right, at this point, that particle disappears and reappears just to the left, turning one. Right? Then this one disappears and becomes the right hand one, but we get the minus one because of the counting algorithm. There's the minus one. Those are the plus one on the right hand side. Okay, so that's where those densities come from. All they're doing is they're counting the paths. Let's iterate it. The next cycle, so we're going to do this. So all we did, this is sort of how superposition comes in, right? All we've done is we've concatenated two trajectories. We just added to this trajectory, and here's what it's done to the two densities.
Are you repeating the same trajectory? So how did you get the second one?
I got the second one by actually just moving this guy up and starting the whole process.
Why would I do that?
Okay. Why? Okay. The question is, in the end, how do you get to what you want? Right? How do you work out, how do you get this thing that makes the pattern of work, the phase, either the INT? And so what you want to do is you want to say, is there a trajectory that organizes this counting process in such a way that you can actually get those two components? So all I'm saying here is, let me do a shift. There was the original thing, then we're going to shift, which doesn't register, and then we're going to count. Okay, because this doesn't register on either of these directions.
And how much did you shift? What's the rule?
Okay, this, I shifted exactly the amount. Oh. To cover where this thing comes. Yes. Now, this is an artificial process. We don't actually need this, but the reason I'm illustrating it with this is simply to show that it has everything you need to do what you want.
Okay. I'm also a little bit puzzled because you were talking about it as a stochastic process before. You have a probability epsilon and so on, but
yes.
Where is that stochastic element here?
No, there's no stochastic element. I've thrown away the stochastic element, I'm zeroing in on saying where we see the complex algebra come in here. So this is completely deterministic. And it also turns out that you can throw away that stochastic element in the model that I showed you, except at the initial condition. You can make the whole process completely deterministic. And it's much more efficient to do that. And so that's sort of a la Bohm. That's what Bohm does. Right? Bohm says, in a sense, you put in these uncertain principle in initial conditions, and it's propagated from there on. Okay. So this is in a sense is a sketch just to show you you've got enough here to do what you want. So here, superposition is concatenation. Right? To get this thing from the original, all we did is we concatenated the path.
Is there some rule, like the actual thing you see in the laboratory corresponds to the, something like the diagram on the right hand side? Because I would have thought that what we would see would just be, many, many particles passing through some small region or something. Like, well, how do you connect this mathematics and this picture to what is actually seen?
Okay. How you connect it is actually not to what's seen, but to the wave function. So, okay, let me just, to answer your question, there's the end of the Stochastic process.
Is that supposed to be psi or psi squared?
Psi. Two components. This is the transient in the way we do it. But you look at this thing, and you've got the two components there. They're in 9 degrees on a phase. We'll see why that is in a minute. It's very straightforward. So what I'm saying, in the Dirac equation, this is the analog of generating e to the imt. So it's the analog of phase. And it's the analog of phase in the Feynman picture, because Feynman associates the phase, and not with a wave, with a trajectory. And we'll see, if you're just patient, we'll see how that actually comes in this very, very primitive model. Okay. If we go back, to answer your question, Lucy, this is the beginning of the description of the path interval. This associates a phase with where you are in space and time along the trajectory.
Okay, but is there a rule then for actually calculating the probability of detecting with?
Detecting with. Okay, that's part of Hamming point, right? This is actually propagation as opposed to getting out the other end. Okay, so this is we sort of want to understand what psi is. So we go back here. So here was two circuits, right? And we just added, we concatenated two paths. So here, it's concatenation. Here, actually, it's superposition. Okay? So, add just a bit more. Oops. Again, we're adding trajectories on the left, and we're watching densities on the right. And notice that this has this feature of propagating the crash. We took that big chunky distribution, and now we've got these periodic ray effects. Right. So we've added length of trajectory and subtracted from those two densities. So there's the end result. Now, going back and saying, okay, well, where is the square root of minus 1 in all this? Let's just track those densities. And we can see that it comes in from the counting. If we look at the path that we're counting, it's sequenced. Right? It's sequenced. Here's the path, right, left, right with a minus one, left with a minus one. So we can sequence it and say, well, okay, it goes right, left, minus right, minus left, right. That's the sequence of the counting for that. Okay, which we're doing here. Right, left, minus right. Let's call that R. So I will just, I don't know, left. Scalar is 1. So if it goes 1, I, minus 1, minus I. So on. That's the sequence generated in the counter. Now, of course, where I has its usual meaning. It's just 1, I, minus 1, minus I, 1, minus 1. Okay? So a convenient way of counting this is simply to say, all right, let's look at this thing and say, here is one of these enumerated. Trajectory has a plot associated with it, which goes around continuously. This guy doesn't have a clock. It has four points. Right. One, I, minus one, minus one. And that's counting. All it's doing is counting. So, of course, the ultimately the question is that really what's this? This is. Okay, so that's the connection with the algebra. I'm pretty well.
Feynman did something similar when we saw.
can we, in a sense, mimic this, go to a part of a dominating paradigm and still have waves? This thing here, you know, sure, it looks like waves, right? It looks like the first eigenstate for particle on a ring, which is what it's mimicking. But in fact, as a fact, that's just the space-time history of the discounting of one of these deterministic entwined patterns. You didn't have to, it's not the one that we saw gave the Dirac equation, it's the deterministic version of that, which is much more efficient. And this is, of course, you know, this is what you get. So that's what the, you know, that's what the wave looks like in the particle paradigm when you use the particle count. Okay, so conclusions. Okay, so what this was about was you know, developing quite a funny picture of propagation. Here, waves appear as derived concepts. There's no physics involved. It's only half counting in geometry. There's nothing, we didn't see any Hamiltonian, we didn't see any special relativity, we didn't see any of that stuff. Of course, its image buried everything there, but we didn't have to invoke it. So we got the Dirac equation, one plus one dimension. And we got there by using these non-simple stochastic reduced entwined patterns. And the only assumption we really had to rely on was the fact long enough to use an equilibrium distribution. Okay, the southern interference appears to be robust. I mean, there are lots of models that will do this. It's not fine-tuned for a very particular geometry or method of traversing the paths. And so that's really it. Thanks a lot for coming and listening. Any questions?
So still trying to follow up on my earlier question. Is this model meant to be providing an ontology as to what is actually going on in the world? I mean, this particle, is this just to be regarded as a mathematical tool, or is it meant to be regarded as a picture of what's actually happening?
Okay. Well, the reason it's there is it's an attempt to try and understand quantum mechanics. And I'm going back to try and understand the mathematics, in a sense, that's what we have. So, in my mind, yes, this is, I hope, going to help with understanding quantum mechanics. But as far as it's got, I mean, Penrose had this useful picture of dividing quantum mechanics into the U process and the R process, the unitary propagation and the reduction of the wave pattern. This, at this point, doesn't say anything about the R process, but it says a lot about the U process. We always think of U process in terms of waves, and that's because our language uses partial differential equations or wave equations. What this is doing is saying, well, look, we could actually turn the whole thing completely around and say, let's stick to the particle paradigm, and can we create waves within the particle paradigm? And the answer is, yes, you can.
The mere fact that you get something which mathematically are waves still doesn't answer the question of how you actually connect those waves to what is seen, to what is actually
that,
in the experiment.
That's absolutely true. So all you've got is another context for the Dirac equation or the Schrodinger equation.
So say you take, for example, the double slit interference experiment, can you give an account of why? You know, the example you showed at the beginning of the talk. Could you give an example of why we see an interference pattern in the first place?
Yes. You can simulate it just in the same way that you can simulate the parts in the box by just saying, instead of a part in a box, we can put it in a box with, you know, two slits. And because you have a propagator, you know everything you need to know about it. It means that, here we've got two slits. You start it out here, if you start some fine path going, and allow it to scan through all of it, that then it will indeed, you know, do this and give you the resulting waveform. But then you come back to me and say, well, that's all right. You've got this resulting waveform. And what's that got to do with the body? Right? Don't really know, but one way you can think of it is if you've got the wave pattern, if you have a detector sitting here, and the detector will respond to the wave pattern, and at some point it'll say, gotcha, you're not going back. Right? You're not going back to the past, keep on inviting us. Then you have two things. You have what was written on the history of space time, and you have one unpaired path. You can think of the way the wave function evolves. Most people tend to think of it in terms of the quantum potential. But in a sense, it's something that you have to think of as being written on space-time.
So does that explain why it's unlikely to see this click happening at a zero?
Yes. Because here, all this says, this is counting. You can take this, and you take the graph equation one dimension, take its non-relativistic image, and you'll get the Feynman phase for that. And the way Feynman keeps that is to say, okay, if you've got hump here and you know, nodes there, what's happening at these nodes is simply the phase is canceling. But then that's the counting argument in this relativistic case where you really do the counting, well, inner scale where you do the counting, and the phase, in actual fact, is a, it comes into the statistics. So the connection is, the writing on space-time, this entwined path, gives you the elements you need for the wave function. The connection to measurement then can either be through Bohm to say, this thing can write that information on a wave function and then use it, allied with quantum potential. Or you can ascribe the measurement process to be more draconian and say, well, okay, in the end, a measurement interferes with this particle arriving on space-time, catches it, prevents it from going back to the past. Once it does that, it can no longer write on this area of space-time, and it's detected. And the particle aspect is from the fact that there really is this one trajectory that doesn't align.
That would seem to be a really dubious way to think about it, right? Because you catch the particle and then it can't go backward in time. But the particle, you know, the trajectory is there, you're up here, there is a trajectory, you know, backward, well, there isn't. I would think, although I'm kind of wondering which one of these.
Well, that's it, except that quantum mechanics is so peculiar in the sense that
right.
We you can replace Bohr's nothingness with that will distribute the information over space-time. And then the question is, how do you use it? How does it bother you? A fairly sensible-looking thing, it means both. But you can also see where a collapse version could work as well, in the sense that if that process is interrupted at some point by the capture, and history is then written forever, you have a one unpaired pattern. You have the history that was written on space. So.
But the detector could also go backwards and then use the particle.
All of this hinges on the direction of time, and so which is somehow agreed upon by the outside world, which you think is detectors. Okay, so.
Well, this is sort of elliptically related to this, but it's a test of thinking for tech is, you know, physically it's classical measuring devices with some sort of arrow built in from the LinkedIn generation. But how do you get, I'm sure you can't, but I just don't quite see how the classical one comes out of this. So you, M comes up, M goes up, and then you lose this interference pattern. I'm just trying to understand it in your terms.
Okay.
I mean, I'm assuming that's what happens.
Yes. Well, I haven't said in this thought case, the non-stochastic version of this is much, much closer to classical mechanics, because you can actually take, it's a way of taking the trajectory and saying, well, okay, here's S, here's T, this is what classical trajectory looks like. Well, the deterministic version says, you can have that, you don't have to have waves. And when you look at it, you know, yeah. There are actually two of these lines. These two lines actually generate phase, and they look like, you know, Heinz would probably look at it and say, well, okay, it's a chain of creation and annihilation of this. So if you step back from one of these things, you can imagine, in a sense, narrow the pencil as opposed to plain ones. See, there is actually a strong classical feel in this, in that the thing that one works with in quantum mechanics, plain waves, they're horrible, right? You know, they extend over all space. Nobody really believes them in the sort of, well, you know, about that, you know, to think that this piece of chalk is described by a plain wave that extends to both ends of the universe. It's a pretty clumsy type of description. Whereas this, with these lines, it's like having plane waves over finite support. You can generate a plane wave with finite support. So they're intrinsically more localized. So the picture is I think, more appealing in terms of how we can react to classical machines. Okay, well, thanks for being here.